first of all, the way a rabbi is appointed in this country is done in a manner which is completely above the heads of the actual members of the community or the neighborhood or the town that we're discussing. The same, what I just said to you now is equally true, essentially, of the rabbi of Kiryat Gat or the rabbi of Haifa. Doesn't really make a difference. The way these people are chosen is by an almost secretive and convoluted political, entirely politically charged procedure, in which political parties and other interested individuals with a particular connection or some well connected individuals in political corridors somehow arrange that so and so will become the rabbi, whether it's of a shul or of a neighborhood or of a town. And it's all done according to political lines and for political reasons. And essentially, it's more a question of providing jobs for certain people than anything else. The same, of course, by the way, is true of the appointment of dayanim, rabbinical court judges here in Israel. It's also done, as is well known, and it's very open, no one really hides this, it's done according to along political lines, based on political considerations, not at all based on the merits of the individual or the case or the place involved. For example, some years ago there were six positions that needed to be filled of dayanim, and the relevant committee met. The result of that committee meeting was that, well, there are six positions and some of us are Mafdal people and some of us are Shas people, so let's just divide it up, three, you take three, we'll take three, and let's go home. That was the end of the meeting, essentially, and that's what they agreed to. This is going back some years, but nothing's changed. Another example, which is something which is happening in the here and now, which will or won't affect those of us who live in Yerushalayim, but in some ways I think it will affect every Jew, really, because the question of who the rabbi of Jerusalem is, I think, is a question of some importance, or should be a question of some importance. In the coming months, as I understand it, there is supposed to be an election for the rabbi of Jerusalem. Some of you may have heard about this. For many years, by the way, there hasn't been a rabbi of Jerusalem. And if you want to know why, the answer is exactly the same. It's all politics. They haven't been able to agree on a procedure or a candidate or what have you. So the issue was put off and off for many years since the former chief rabbi of Yerushalayim passed away. Now, there are those who are interested for whatever reason to have a national religious type rabbi as rabbi of Jerusalem, or those who want a Haredi type rabbi as rabbi of Jerusalem. And you can all guess, without me telling you, who's interested in what and for what reason. And therefore, you understand that the whole thing is a question of horse trading and all kinds of deals, backroom deals, that are being cut and made as we speak. What the result will be, I have no idea, but I do know that the entire procedure is being done above the heads of the Jews of Yerushalayim. In fact, many of the people, many of the rabbis even, who are somehow involved in trying to pick or come up with an agreed-upon candidate for the religious Zionist community to put forward, are people who don't even live in Yerushalayim. Not necessarily bad people, people like Rav Yaakov Ariel, the Rav of Ramat Gan, for example, the big Tamid Chachamim, etc., but it's also nevertheless a fact that he has nothing to do with Yerushalayim. Why is he involved in such a discussion? Not clear. However, it is very clear that the Jews of Yerushalayim are not involved in such a discussion, not involved in such a process. They have nothing to do with it. No one's asking them. They're not going to be able to express any opinion. It's true that, according to the law, the election has to be done in such a way that, I don't remember the figures, but a certain number of gabbaim, of batei knesset in Yerushalayim, have to, at least are a major portion of the electoral body. I think maybe it's 85 or 75 or 60 or something like that, Gaba'im of Batei Knesset in Yerushalayim. Now, we all know that in Yerushalayim there's probably something like, I don't know, 10,000 shuls, not 30, not 60, not 85. There's literally 60 shuls just in a 5-minute radius of where we're sitting right now. And I know because I once counted. So there are thousands of shuls in Yerushalayim. To choose 60 or 85 or even 200 is meaningless, because the question is who's doing the choosing? Who's choosing those 200? The whole thing is stacked and prearranged and very very dishonest. So the point that I'm making is that if we take the very essential idea of a rav of a community, the way things are done here in Eretz Yisrael leave one wondering, is this how it's supposed to work, and why does it work in this fashion? Now, if you compare everything I just said to what goes on in Chutz Laaretz, shall we say, let's say you have a community of Jews, for argument's sake, in Toronto, Canada. What's a community of Jews? In practical terms, that means a shul where certain people habitually go and meet during the week on Shabbat, etc. And they associate in a legal and in some binding manner, and they form a community. And if they want to choose a rabbi for their community, well, it's obvious, isn't it, that they're the ones who choose. Whether they make the right choice and how exactly they choose is something we can discuss, but not now. But they're the ones who choose.
What if there's three or four shuls?
There are three or four shuls in Toronto. In fact, there are probably 300 shuls in Toronto, or I don't know, 100 shuls in Toronto. And each one of them, in their own turn, in their own time, choose the rabbi that suits them.
For their own shul.
For their own shul, because in Chutz Laaretz, a shul is a community. In other words, if you belong to this shul, you go to that shul, then you're part of that community. If you go to shul X, then you belong to community X, essentially. You pay membership dues, and therefore, usually if there's a general meeting or some kind of asefa, then you also have a vote, you have a say. Of course, they probably choose an executive committee, whatever, which is perfectly normal and legitimate. But every shul, every decent-sized shul, which probably has at the very least 50 families as members, probably 100 or hundreds of families as members, they all belong to that community, and to that shul, and they form a community. Each one of those shuls is actually a community unto itself, just as, for example, in the time of Rashi, in the Alsace region on the border of France and Germany, you had Jewish communities, which in those days were not separate communities in the one large city like Toronto, which is a huge place, but obviously much smaller, on a much smaller scale. But you had a town here and a town there, another town further down the river. And each town had its Jewish community. Sometimes, by the way, historically, we know, sometimes exceedingly small, sometimes literally 20, 30 families, sometimes even less, other times more. 80 families was already a large community. But each of those towns and each of the communities in those towns, they were a community unto themselves, and they had their own Beit Din, as we'll discuss presently, their own Chacham, their own Rav, etc., and they chose it. The Goyim in Germany in the 11th century did not tell the Jews whom to choose as Rav of Worms, for example, where Rashi lived. And I think you can all guess practically speaking, who the Rav of Worms was. And it goes without saying that today in Toronto, or for that matter in London, or New York, or Melbourne, we all know that the government in that country, so if it's Toronto, the Canadian government has no interest, and therefore also no say, in which rabbi is chosen by which community. They don't pay the bill, and they have nothing, and there are no political parties have no axe to grind. So the community is autonomous to a very large degree. Again, I'm not trying to paint some utopian, rosy picture whereby everything is just wonderful the wrong people are never chosen, or the wrong people are wrong, not the wrong people not are not chosen are chosen for running the community as being the executive committee, or the wrong rabbi is chosen. These things can happen, but the community is responsible for itself. Why? Because the larger structure, the state, the country, is not involved. Here in Israel, it is not so, and therefore we have also lost a great deal. We have lost the idea and the concept of a Jewish community. And this is a very serious issue which should concern us.
In Chutzlar, it's almost every synagogue has a rabbi that the people choose, that you're saying forms a community, each one. In Israel, most synagogues don't have a rabbi that is chosen for each synagogue. So automatically
You're right. You're right. That's perhaps part of the problem. But even where you do have a rabbi chosen, or for, shall we say, for a neighborhood, and every shchuna and every city in Israel has a rabbi, and a rabbi whose salary is paid by the state, etc. Let's ask ourselves: who chose this rabbi, and what does he do? Whom is he serving? Etc., etc. These are just some of the questions that we should be wondering about. So the general claim here is that the concept of a Torah-based Jewish or Jewish communal life based on Torah principles, that concept, that reality, has to a large extent been lost. Here, Dafka, of all places, in Israel, which is a paradox, but it's a fact. Now, just to back up complete the picture, let's see what Chazal say on this issue of a Jewish community. How do Chazal define a Jewish community? So for this we're going to look now in Masechet Sanhedrin. Those of you who have Talmud Bavli or Mishnah even in front of you.
Are they describing a Jewish community in Galut?
Both. I think the answer is both. But certainly in Israel, because the Mishnah is relating to the reality in Eretz Yisrael at that time. But I think essentially the same pattern and the same institutions and the same concepts were understood and implemented in Chutz La'aretz as well. Where there is a certain difference between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz for certain reasons, that difference is pointed out. So the first source is the Mishnah. What does the Mishnah say? This Mishnah is to be found, it's the last Mishnah towards the end of the first perek of Masechet Sanhedrin. If you have the Talmud Bavli in front of you, I'll tell you exactly where it is. Just one moment. It starts on Daf. Well, the complication is that for reasons that don't matter right now, all the Mishnah, the first perek, appears on the first page of the Masechet. So it's best to go first to the beginning of the Masechet, and we'll read the relevant part of the Mishnah. Then we'll jump to the page in the Gemara where it's discussed.
The first Mishnah.
No, it's towards the end of the first perek. So what does this perek of Mishnah discuss? First, two sentences about this perek of the Mishnah. The first perek of Masechet Sanhedrin discusses Batei Din, the different kinds of Batei Din that we have according to the Torah. We have Batei Din of Shelosha. That's why the Mishnah begins by discussing Dinei Mamonot Bishlosha. In other words, monetary disputes are to be adjudicated by a Beit Din of 3. Later on, it goes to discuss a Beit Din of 23. Which is also qualified to judge even capital cases where capital punishment is a possibility. And the highest court, of course, is the Sanhedrin HaGadolah, the Beit Din HaGadol of 71. So the first question is, what type of place is, what type of town or community is eligible and therefore also required to have a Beit Din of 3, What kind of town or community is eligible and therefore required to have a Bet Din of 23? As for a Bet Din of 71, there's only one for all of Am Yisrael. So the Bet Din discusses, the Mishnah discusses a Bet Din of 23, and then at the end it says as follows. This is to be found on Daf Beth, Amud Beth, at the top of the page, in the Talmud Bavli, the very top. It says, "V'chama yehe ba'ir, utaher ru'ya l'sanhedrin." How many people must there be in a city, in a town, and that it should be considered ra'uy to have a Sanhedrin, that is to say, of 23? A Sanhedrin, the term Sanhedrin either means a Bet Din Gadol, Sanhedrin Gadola of 71, or a Sanhedrin Ketana of 23. Here is referring to a Sanhedrin Ketana of 23. How many people need to be in a town in order for that town to be eligible and therefore required, obligated, to have a Bet Din of 23 in its midst? The Mishnah says, Me'a u'esrim, 120 people. That may sound like not terribly large place to you, and you might be right, because everything is very different nowadays. If you're talking about 120 people, and we'll see, it's talking about 120 men, adult men. My understanding would be, first of all, that essentially, that in practical terms, that means approximately 120 families. There may be a few young unmarried men and some of the families, so you could actually count, maybe you have 100 families, 120 young men, but or men altogether, but essentially 120 means 120 families. How much is 120 families? Well, if we were to go up here, up to the street above, and we were to mark out four or five buildings, we'd have 120 families, without any exaggeration. There are buildings with 20 families in them. So five such buildings, you have 100 families already, okay? How does that compare to what once was in the time of Chazal? Well, here I can tell you a brief story. That quite a number of years ago, I was in Susia. Susia is a place, there's a yeshuv called Susia in Drom Har Hebron, south of Hebron. And there's also the ancient town of Susia that was found and excavated nearby. In other words, there was a place called Susia going back apparently at least 1800 years or something, if not more. And most of the town has been excavated, so you can actually see the houses and you can see the size of the place. And after walking around it for a couple of hours, I bumped into this individual and I started talking to him, and it transpired, became obvious from the conversation, he was actually a professor of archaeology and he knew quite a bit about the whole place. And I asked him several questions. One of the questions I asked him was, tell me, at its height, how many people lived in this town of Susia? He said, at its height, which was approximately the 5th century, there were 500 families in Susia, and he said it was one of the largest towns in Eretz Yisrael at the time, and that was at its height. There were times when it was 200 families, there were times it was 100 families, and eventually it dwindled into nothing because of the Muslim conquest and the breakdown of law and order in that part of the country, so that the people just fled. That was sometime after the Arab conquest of Eretz Yisrael in the late 7th or 8th, early 8th century, ceased to exist. So 500 families was a very large place. 120 families, or people, and therefore families, mentioned by the Mishnah, is a very average, was a very average kind of a place. It wasn't a big town. It was an average town. So every average town, according to the first opinion of the Mishnah, must have within its borders, within as part of its communal setup, it must have a Beth Din of 23 Chachamim. Not one, and not three, not a Rav of a Shchuna, not a Rav of the town, which is one person, a Beth Din of 23 people. According to Rabbi Nehemiah is the other opinion in the Mishnah, and according to all the Posekim, Halakha is not like Rabbi Nehemiah, even though in the Tosefta the opinion is expressed that Halakha is like Rabbi Nehemiah, but all the Rishonim do not posek that way, including the Rambam. Rabbi Nehemiah says, Mathaim Ushaloshim, 230 families. He also gives a reason, which we're going to discuss, but not today. He says, Kenegret Sare Asaroth, which is something which has to be understood in a separate shiur. He's referring to the Sarei Asarot that, that Yithro recommended to Moshe Rabbeinu that he set up. What exactly that Eitzah was? What exactly was it? What system was Yithro suggesting to Moshe Rabbeinu that he put in place? And how did it work, etc.? That is actually a much less simple matter to understand than may at first meet the eye. But the halakha is 120. This is also what the Rambam writes, as we'll see in a moment. So 120, a town of 120 families roughly, is supposed to have a Beth Din of 23 Chachamim. Now, if you jump to the end of the Perek in the Talmud Bavli, which is to Daf Yod Zayin Amud Beth, towards the bottom of the page, Yod Zayin Amud Beth, Yud Zayin Amud Beth. A few lines from the bottom, it says, "V'chama yehe ba'ir v'yehe ru'ya l'sanhedrin me'ah v'esrim." That's the quote from the Mishnah Amud Beth, Yud Zayin Amud Beth. You got that? "V'chama yehe ba'ir v'yehe ru'ya l'sanhedrin me'ah v'esrim." You see that?
Where is it on the
page?
Okay.
Yeah, you got it. Very good. So the Gemara asks, Me'awa esri ma'avith taiho, which means, these 120 people that you're referring to, how did you arrive at this figure? It's a very interesting question. What do you mean, how did you arrive at this figure? We just said a very simple thing, really, you would imagine. If a town has 120 families, it needs to have such a setup, has to have a Sanhedrin of 23 Chachamim. Okay, what do you mean, how did you arrive at 120? That figure seemed to the Chachamim to be a large enough place to warrant such a thing. After all, you couldn't demand that every place that has 20 families have a Beddin of 23 or 30 families. So there has to be some minimal cutoff number. Most of the Chachamim thought 120 was a sufficient number that requires such an institution in the town. Rabbi Nechemiah thought otherwise, but even he doesn't blow the number up out of all proportion. He says even less than double that amount. Nevertheless, the Talmud asks the question, Mai Avith Tayo, which means, essentially, how did you arrive at this number? How did you get to 120? So the Gemara now goes through several lines of explanation. It says, Esrimu Shalosha Keneged Sanhedrin Ketana. There's actually a discussion amongst the Rishonim what this means. Most Rishonim understand that it means that, well, you want to know how we got to 120. Well, first we got to 23 because we have to have 23 people on the Beit Din. That's the explanation of most of the Rishonim. The Rama, with the Hay, Rabbi Meir Alevi Abu Lafia, explains in Yad Rama that it actually means an extra another 23. In other words, he explains the entire count here as excluding the Sanhedrin of 23. In other words, all these people that we're mentioning now are not included in the Sanhedrin of 23. So what are these 23? These 23 are replacements in case something happens to the first 23. Someone dies, have to be replaced. If they all die in a plague, someone has to replace them. So one way or the other, the cheshbon is as follows. So says the Gemara. Esrim u'shlosha keneged Sanhedrin ktana. Shalosh shurot shel esrim u'shlosha. That means three rows of Talmidim, each row containing 23 Talmidim, students who are sitting in front of the Beth Din and listening to the discussion and learning from that discussion. They're not members of the Sanhedrin, but they are future members, perhaps, of that Beth Din. They are learning how this is done. They're studying, they're learning Torah, they're hearing the debate, etc., etc. As is discussed elsewhere in the Mishnah Masechet Sanhedrin. So you have three rows of 23. 3 times 23 is 69, plus if we have the 23 from the original 23 we mentioned, if, let's say for now it includes the Beit Din, so that's 92. The Gemara also knew the number. Asara batlanim shebet hakeneset. Asara batlanim is a concept which appears in other places, such as in Masechet Megillah, which means another 10 people, which is 102. What are these 10 people? They're called batlanim. What's a batlan? A batlan is someone who does not work. Why does he not work? Because the community needs to have 10 people whose job it is to be in the Beit Knesset, be in the Beit Midrash, either to that it should be a place of study, of Torah study and teaching, to take care of the different things that go on the Beit Knesset, that it should always be a minyan when a minyan is necessary in the Beit Knesset. It should never be a situation where there's no minyan available. Chazal say that a Jewish community that respects itself and wishes to function properly has to have asara batlanim, who do not work, do not have another job, do not have a day job. The other, by the way, the other 23 and the 23 and the 69, they do have a job. No one said they have to be full-time employees of this Beit Din setup. That doesn't mean the Beit Din has to meet every day 9 to 5 or 8 to 6 or what have you, 6 days a week or 5 days a week. That's not so. They can meet on certain occasions as required, perhaps, or have regular scheduled meetings, for example, once every 2 or 3 weeks for 2 hours, discuss things that have to be discussed, decide things that need to be decided. And if something comes up, such as some kind of a court case, maybe it's a monetary dispute between two people in the town, or chas v'shalom, something worse than that, criminal case, so they're there to deal with it, true. But they have jobs, they make a living. But these asara batlanim do not make a living from their own work. They are supported by the community in order to ensure that there should be, as Rashi and Yad Rama and others explain, there should be a minyan, there should be people available to teach Torah, give shiurim, worry about the Beit Knesset, etc. So that's 102. On top of that, Shnei Soferim, says the Gemara, which means two secretaries, really, who are present when the Beit Din meets to write down, to record the debate and the decisions. Shnei Hazanim, the Hazanim referred to here are also court officers who, if necessary, bring a person who has to appear before the Beit Din. They bring him before the Beit Din if he didn't show up or what have you. So that's another two, that's 106. Shnei Ba'alei Dinim, now if you have a Beit Din, usually you at least have two people who come before the Beit Din with a problem, with a complaint. So that's another two people. That's 108. Shnei Edim, and you have to have two witnesses, that's 110. And Shnei Zomamim, and if sometimes the Torah talks about the possibility that when you have witnesses who lie, other witnesses can come forward and say their testimony can't be right, because we know that on that day, at that time, they were with us, and they weren't where they claimed they were. So that's Shnei Edim Zomamim and Shnei Zomamei Zomamim, people who can also refute what the refuters claim. So that's another six. So you get to, that's 114. And now we have, on top of that, we have a Baraitha that's now quoted by the Talmud, which says, Kol ir she'en ba'asara devarim halalu en tamil hachamim rashai ladur b'tocha, which means any town. The word ir, by the way, doesn't mean what we understand today by the word city. I mean, cities of a scale of which we know were not known really in those days, with maybe one or two exceptions. The word ir, as we also see from the Masechet Megillah, when talking about the reading of Megillah and Purim, an ir was a relatively small place. A large city was called a krach, right? A krach are those places where usually with the walled cities, that's where you read the Megillah on the 15th, not the 14th, for example. That's why it's discussed in Masechet Megillah. So don't be misled by the term ir. Ir just means a town, maybe just a large village. Okay, a kfar, what the Mishnah in Megillah refers to as a kfar, is a very, very small place where you don't even have maybe a minyan of Jews or something like that, or barely have a minyan, or you don't have enough people who know how to read the Megillah, so they have to go to the town next door to hear the Megillah read, or something like that. That's a very, very, very negligible village. A kfar. A kfar is a village. So an ir is a town, and a city, even in those days, was called by another name, namely a krach. So the Braitha now states, Kol ir she'en ba'asarat devarim halalu, en tamid chachamim rasha ladur b'tocha. A town in which these following 10 things do not exist, are not in place. In other words, this is a community that doesn't have these things set up. A Tamid Chachamim should not live in such a place. So it says in the Braitha. What is a Tamid Chachamim, by the way? Also a term that is often misunderstood. So let's clarify. A Tamid Chachamim is not, as it's used today, to mean a great Torah scholar. The word Talmid Chachamim, what it means, what we would call today, a person who studied in yeshiva for a couple of years, and he's the kind of person who knows and cares about what he does and follows the instructions and the direction of people much greater than himself, of Chachamim, who tell him this is the right thing to do, or this is what you should do, etc. Or he knows at least how to ask the right questions. That's a Talmid Chachamim. Not a person who's a Chacham himself. He literally, the student of Chachamim, a Talmid Chachamim. How did it come to be that this term is often used today to refer to people who are really Chachamim and not Talmidei Chachamim? This is actually out of a kind of humility. In other words, great Chachamim in the past used to refer to themselves as just as Talmidei Chachamim. And therefore the terms became, as it were, interchangeable. But in essence, there's actually a very clear distinction between a Talmid Chachamim and a Chacham. A Chacham is what we would call today the Rav, the important Chacham, and the Talmid Chachamim are his students or the people who listen to him. As opposed to what? As opposed to an Am Haaretz who doesn't listen at all, who doesn't care. So you have to have the following things in place in a town for a Talmid Chachamim, that is to say what we would call today a yeshiva boy, a person who once studied in yeshiva, what we would call today a good balabait, a guy who goes to a shiur regularly and he tries to run his life according to the Torah. That's a Talmid Chachamim. If he hasn't got these things in a certain town or a community, he shouldn't live there. So says the Braitha. What are these things? Beth Din Makin Wa'onashim. A Beth Din, as we just described, for example, of 23. A Beth Din that, where necessary, punish people who require punishment, such as giving them a whipping, a lashing, etc., or other forms of punishment. And, of course, a place where a person can take another person if he has a complaint against him, such as a monetary dispute. So you have to have a Beth Din Makin or Onshim. A Beth Din is able to enforce the law, not just to make a pronouncement, but don't actually enforce it. A kupasha sadaka, which means a community fund for charitable purposes, to help the poor of the community. And to run such a kupasha sadaka, as it says in Masechet Bava Batra, nigbeth b'shnayim u'mithalekat b'shlosha. You need two people to do the collection of the dues, and it is dues, by the way. It's not voluntary. If you, as is discussed in Masechet Pe'ah and in Masechet Bava Batra, if you belong to a certain community, if you are a Jew in this community, there's a certain tax that you have to pay, and one of those taxes is to the charitable fund, and it's collected by two people together, so there should be no possibility and no tongues wagging, well, reduce the possibility of embezzlement and other practices. And mithalek bishlosha, and it's given out, the money is dispersed by three people, because three is essentially a beth din, and they have to judge whether who this person is and how much he really needs, and if he's honest or dishonest, if the picture he presents is a true picture or not, which is not a simple matter. Has to be, the money is dispersed by three. So you need at least three people to run just the kupash el sadakah. And you have to have a beth knesset, have to have a shul. We discussed before that a shul is essentially, in Chutzlat certainly, a shul is a community. Well, in every community you have to have a shul, you have to have a place to pray as a community, and a beth merhatz, which today you may think is obvious, which it is, but then it is maybe less obvious. You need to have a public bathhouse so that a person can live in a normal fashion. And in those days, as the Rambam writes in the Chot De'ot, bathing was something that you did maybe once a week. So it was done usually Erev Shabbat. So at least Erev Shabbat, you should be able to go and prepare for Shabbat and Yom Tov, etc. Also, Beth HaKiseh, it says here. Beth HaKiseh, he refers to sanitary sanitation, or at least the kind of they had in those days. Rofe is a doctor, and Uman is literally is a blood letter, which was also which was considered a kind of medical occupation in those days, and actually till fairly recent times. There are those who also explain that the Uman he refers to a mohel, to a person who knows how to do brith milah for children that are born. A lavlar is a sofer, a person who writes svarim and tefillin and mezuzot and sifrei Torah. You have to have such a person in the community. And you have to have a tabach. A tabach is what we call today a shohet. In other words, a person knows how to shecht animals to provide kosher meat for people. Umelamed tinokot, and someone to teach the children Torah. So you have to have what we would call today a Talmud Torah. You have to have a school. You have to have a school for the children. You have to have a Beth Knesset. You have to have a doctor. You have to have a bathhouse. You have to have a charity fund, a community fund, which it is an obligation to pay a weekly due to. And if you don't pay, you can be forced to pay. It's like today you have Hotzah Lapo'al, right? You have there's a way to enforce a court decision. That's exactly how it was then as well. If so-and-so was supposed to pay into the Kupasha Sadakah a certain amount and didn't do so, the Beit Din would... first they'd ask him, what's going on? Why aren't you paying? And if he just refuses to pay, he would be forced to pay. So these two lists of people that we just read here, which we now will look at in the Rambam, by the way, these two lists of people actually provide us with a very interesting picture, paint a very interesting picture of what a Jewish community is in the most basic terms. A Jewish community, therefore, according to what we just saw here, is a place, if as long as there's 120 families in it, and by the way, 120 families today means that many, many yeshuvim, shall we say, in Yudan Shomron, or moshavim in different parts of the country, are also fall within this category, right? There are yeshuvim today in different parts of the country, in Yudan Shomron, where you have 500 families, or even 1,000 families. But 120 families is not such a large place. So a Jewish community is a place where you have a Beth Knesset and a school for children, and you have a charity, tzedakah, which is collected and dispersed, etc., etc. And you also have at the center, the focal point of this community, is a Beth Din of 23 people. Now, we can discuss later, and we will discuss another shiur, how do you get to 23 people? What if you haven't got 23 people who know very much? All right, so then we'll see what are the minimal requirements in terms of knowledge for such a local Beth Din. And we'll see that it's the requirements aren't necessarily as difficult or as unrealistic as you might imagine. The Rambam lists all these things in Hilchot Sanhedrin Din Perek Aleph. So you have the Rambam in front of you. You should open up Hilchot Sanhedrin Din Perek Aleph. And the Rambam says as follows. I read from the beginning. Mitzvah Aseh Shel Torah. It is a mitzvah of the Torah. You see it? Mitzvah Aseh Shel Torah. It is a mitzvah of the Torah. Lemanoth Shoftim Ushoftorim Bechol Medina Medina. The word Medina does not mean a country. It means a large walled city. That's what the word Medina in the Tanakh always means. And also in Chazal. What we call today modern Hebrew Medina was in an ancient parlance was referred to as a melucha, or a mamlacha, or a kingdom. That's why you have, for example, in Saudi Arabia, a town called Medina. Medina means, it was a large city, a walled city, it was called Medina. So Medina means any large city, usually a walled city. Mitzvah ta'aseh shel Torah lemanot shofatim u'shotorim b'chol Medina u'Medina, in every city, u'b'chol pelech u'felech, in every region. She'ne'emar shofatim u'shotorim titen lecha b'chol she'arecha. The Torah says explicitly that you have to appoint judges, shofatim, and shotarim, policemen, that is to say, officers who enforce the decisions of that court, b'chol sha'arecha, in all your habitations, in other words, in all communities, essentially. And the Rambam explains, shofatim, elu adayanim hakevu'im b'veth din. The word shofatim in the Torah refers to the dayanim who sit in the Beit Din and hear the cases and make decisions. Uva'alei dinim ba'im lifnehem, that the people come before them when they have a problem. And who are the shoterim? Says the Rambam. Hashoterim eru ba'alei makhel uresu'ah. These are literally policemen who even carry what we would call today a nightstick or a riot stick or whatever they have. They carry. They have implements with which to enforce the Beit Din's decision. Maybe I don't know if they had water hoses at that time, but it worked.
Machine guns.
Ah, you were referring to machine guns. I see. All right. Well, it doesn't. I don't think that was the idea. No. והם העומדים לפני הדיינים, המסבבים בשווקים ועל החנויות לתקן השערים ומידות. In other words, these are policemen, community policemen, whose job it is, amongst other things, says the Rambam, to patrol in the marketplace and the main streets. The word shuk means a marketplace or a main street. And no, it doesn't say exactly how many. No, I suppose it depends on what is feasible and the needs of the place. To make sure that commercial practices are maintained as they should be according to halacha, if necessary, punish those who do evil. And these shotrim don't do things off their own bat; they have to be instructed by the Beit Din to do this or to do that, except for standard things. And if they see someone doing something very wrong, one of their job descriptions is to bring that person before the Beit Din and tell them we saw him do this or what have you, and the Beit Din will decide what is to be done. And he is to be judged according to the evil that he did, whatever it may have been. Now, is there a difference between Chutz La'aretz and Eretz Yisrael, which was a question that was raised earlier? The Rambam says, based on what it says in the Gemara, "En anu hayavim lehamid batei dinim bechol perech uperech ubechol ir veir, ela be'Eretz Yisrael bilvad." We are only required to establish batei din, as we're about to describe here, in every town and every region, only in Eretz Yisrael. Aval b'chutz La'aretz enan hayavim lehamid bet din bechol perech uperech. So what's the difference? In Chutz La'aretz, you do need a Beit Din in every town, but it's not a regional Beit Din as well. In other words, there's no concept of a region in Chutz La'aretz. There, every, as we described before, every community is an island unto itself. It's in autonomous, and it doesn't belong to a larger network. Whereas in Eretz Yisrael, the country, and this really makes the connection between the two concepts that Rabbi in his books discussed, the idea of a community and the idea of a state. We see already from here, we have the idea of a community, or a town, an ir. And we have today in large cities, you have many, as it were, towns within the city, or you have many communities, which is okay, that's fine. You can have 100 communities, for argument's sake, in a city. So you could have the city of Netanya, could have 100 different communities within it. That's also possible. The cities in a certain area are also somehow connected in a manner which is not described here in detail. In a pelech is a region, and again, this is also not really described here, but one imagines that somehow there is a connection, of course, has to be some interface between the regional network, the regional setup, and the national setup. There has to be some way that the national government deals with the local governments and the communities.
Why in Chutz La'aretz didn't they need to have regional, but they did?
Why did they not need to?
Yeah.
I think it's because the concept of a region doesn't exist. We're in a foreign land. We're not required, and we're also incapable of setting up any kind of regional network. What all we can do in Chutz La'aretz, and all we're required to do, is to ensure that the basic minimum requirements for Jewish communal life exist. And those are the things that we discussed before, which we'll also see in the Rambam in a moment. A Beit Knesset, a Beit Sefer, a Beit Din, and certain other institutions. And that every town, every community has to somehow ensure that exists. Setting up a regional network implies a certain kind of sovereignty. Whereas if you're living in another person's country, another land, you don't have any sovereignty, and you have no What do you mean you were a region? Who are you to set up a region? How did you do it?
There's a certain kind of sovereignty applied just in the Beit Din.
Well, there certainly is a concept of autonomy, at least, shall we call it, involved in the concept of Beit Din. And it's also a fact that historically, until a couple of hundred years ago, approximately, in almost all parts of the world, the Jewish communities were autonomous, very much so, and they had their own Beit Din. And those Batei Din, depending on different historical periods, there were ups and downs. But in many periods of history, the Jewish communities had their own Batei Din that were very powerful, that could in fact judge and punish and do all sorts of things. In some cases, even capital punishment they were empowered to do. But of course, they had to receive permission from the king, from the country in which they lived to do this, but most countries wanted to do that. They wanted the Jews to be separate, and they didn't really care what the Jews did as long as they paid their taxes, even if they had to pay three times as much as someone else, but they had to pay their taxes. But beyond that, you know, you can do your own thing. That was the case, that was the situation in many parts of the Jewish world for many, many hundreds of years. And essentially only began to fall apart, particularly in Europe, in the late 18th and early 19th century, which is also part of the reason we are in the situation in which we find ourselves today. So, get back to the Rambam. The Rambam continues and says, in Halacha Dalet, Kama bate dinim kevoim hiyu b'Yisrael, v'chama yihye minyanam. Alright, so now we're beginning from the top down. The Rambam is giving us a top-down description of how the Jewish people is supposed to be organized in terms of Batei Din. How many Batei Din should there be in the Jewish people, amongst the Jewish people? Halacha Dalet or Gimel, depending on which version you have. Koveim b'tehila beth din ha-gadol b'mikdash. Here we're assuming there's a Mikdash. And there, next to the Mikdash, you have a place called Ishkath HaGazit, where the Sanhedrin HaGadolah used to meet. Wuhu ha-nikra Sanhedrin HaGadolah. Minyanam had was 70, and their number was 71, as we know. I move on to the next halacha. Hagadol b'chokhmah shebechulam, the greatest of those 71, moshivinu to b'rosh aleihem, he is made the president of that body, the head of that body, and he is known also as Rosh HaYeshiva. That is the term that was used by Chachamim for the head of the Sanhedrin, the head of that Beit Din. Uhu shekorin otho Chachamim Nasi b'chol makom, also known by the term Nasi. Uhu ha'omed tahat Moshe Rabbeinu, and he, as it were, is in place of Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, we take the model of the Beit Din of 71 that was established in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moshe Rabbeinu was the Nasi, and there were 70 people under him but with him in this Beit Din. And the same is true for every Beit Din Gadol in history. It has to be 71. The greatest is the replacement, as it were, the substitute for Moshe Rabbeinu. And the next in line, Umoshivim HaGadol Sheba Shivim Mishne LaRosh, the greatest of those 70 remaining Chachamim is his deputy, and he's called the Av Beit Din. Rambam describes certain things that we can skip for now, which we'll discuss another time, about how the Sanhedrin Gedolah sat and what have you. And then the Rambam goes on to say in Halacha Zayin, at least in my version, but in your version it might be the end of Halacha Gimel. It says here, Wa'od ma'amidim shanei batei dinim shel shaloshim shel shalosha u'esrim. Another two batei din of 23 each are also set up right next to the Beit Din of 71. Ehad al petach azara, ehad al petach harabait. One at the entrance to the azara. This is again on harabait, next to the mikdash, and one at the entrance to harabait. So on harabait, which was a large complex, as we know, we see the area today. Even if it was expanded from what it was then, it's still a large place, a large area. There were three batei din just there, and these were national batei din. In other words, they were responsible for and required to deal with the concerns and issues that the Jewish people as a nation, as a people had. So initially a matter could be brought before the first Beit Din of 23 at the entrance to Har HaBayit, where they had a Lishka, and if that they didn't know the answer, they would go to the next Beit Din, which was a higher a higher court of 23 also, which was at the entrance to the Azara, and if they didn't, then we'd go to the Sanhedrin and Gedola. So it's just like a Supreme Court. Obviously, not everything goes straight to the Supreme Court. Now the Rambam goes on to say, "Uma'amidim b'chol ir wa'ir in Israel, in every city, every town in Israel, in Eretz Israel, and this, by the way, we just said before, also applies even in Chutz La'aretz. We said before, what doesn't apply is the pelech, the region, but the town, the same rule applies. Uma'amidim b'chol ir wa'ir mi Israel sheyesh ba 120 or yoter, any town that has 120 people or more, Sanhedrin Ktana, which is 23 chachamim. Ve'yoshevet b'sha'ar ha'ir, and they should meet, their place, the courthouse where they meet should be at the entrance of the city. B'sha'ar ha'ir she'ne'emar u'hisigu b'sha'ar mishpat. V'chama yiyye minyana shalosha u'isrim dayan, 23 dayanim make up such a beth din. V'hagadol b'chukhma she'bechulan rosh aleihem, the greatest amongst them is the head of that beth din. V'hashay yoshevim b'igul kamo hasigor, and they sit and they meet in a semicircular shape, they arrange themselves in a semicircular shape so everyone can see everyone, so everyone can hear everyone. Kadesh Yarosh Ra'et Kulam, so that the head who sits in the center can see everybody. Ramam continues, Ir She'en Ba Me'awu Esrim. So what happened now? That we just said every town of 120 requires such a Beth Din of 23. What do you do if there's not 120 people? Let's say there's only 80 families in this town. Ma'amidim ba shalosha dayanim. You have to have a bed din of three, at least. She'en bed din pachot mi shalosha. Keep this, take note of this statement. She'en bed din pachot mi shalosha. There's no such thing as a bed din less than three. Kadesh she'iye behen rov umi'ut im hayatha benehem machloket bedim min hadinim. So that if there is a discussion, a halachic discussion, and they don't all agree, then you at least have, you can have a majority. There has to be a 2-1 split when you have three people. This, by the way, already calls into some question, I think, the concept of a rav. The rav of a town, rav of a community, rav of a shul. Because when you say that, who's the rav of this neighborhood, or who's the rav of that yeshuv, this implies, and in practice that's what it is, that's what it means, that there is one person who is in that position of being the rav, and he is empowered or expected to make all kinds of decisions. But we see from here that it's en bed din pachot mishlosha. It shouldn't be a one-man show, even if he's a very, very great and outstanding individual. It should always be a bed din of three.
Isn't that always the case?
What do you mean?
I mean, is there a place where the Jews live who have a rabbi and they don't have a bed din of shalosh?
I would say the opposite is the case. I would ask you, being a Jew, of course, I answer a question with a question. Where do you know of a town or a yeshuv that has a bed din of three? I don't know of such a place, do you? I know lots of yeshuvim. I go to many, I visit many, I have relatives who live in many such places. I know, is there a, I have a simple question. As I said to you, I've lived in this neighborhood, Givat Shaul, Yerushalayim, 28 years, 29 years. Is there a bed din of three in this community, in this neighborhood that is empowered by and recognized by the entire neighborhood and community? No such thing. There is a bed din.
Is there a bed din? Are there a group of three people in this neighborhood who meet when anybody wants to present a case? Whether they're recognized or not, okay, doesn't say in here either.
No, of course it does. It does actually say, because the Rambam, when the Rambam says ma'amidim, what does ma'amidim mean? As the Rambam will explain soon, ma'amidim means that these bodies, these institutions that we're discussing, are not self-appointed. Even if you have three Talmidei Chachamim, very serious Chachamim, if they haven't been appointed in a proper manner, and they haven't got any way of enforcing what they say, what they want to, what they think needs to be done, they're not a bed din. That's not a bed din. And to fully illustrate this point, I'll tell you something that it says in Masechet Ta'aniyot. It says in the Mishnah, Masechet Ta'aniyot, that in Eretz Yisrael, as we know, we often are short of rain, of water. what happens in the winter and there's not enough rain, the Beth Din, the local Beth Din, depending on the area, because sometimes this region has more rain, the other region has less, what have you. The local Beth Din is to declare a series of fast days, which are days of prayer and introspection and teshuvah, etc., to pray for everything, and particularly for rain. So says the Mishnah in Masechet Taniyot. The Gemara says in the Talmud Bavli, "En Tanit Sibur beBavel." There is no such thing as a public fast day in Bavel. What does that mean? Obviously, Jews in Bavel fast at Yom Kippur and on Tisha B'Av and a few other days of the year, days of mourning. So what is it referring to? So without going into all the details now, and it's a very interesting but involved discussion, Tanit Sibur, what's referred to there is Tanit Sibur is a 24-hour fast like Yom Kippur or Tisha B'Av, which is decreed by the Beit Din for the purpose of praying for rain, etc. So it's a serious fast day, which was declared when necessary by the local Beit Din Eretz Israel, and then all the Jews of that town or that community are required to fast on that day, and if this rain doesn't fall for a while beyond that, then other fast days are announced, and even days, sometimes these days become days of a public holiday, so to speak, where no work is done, like Tisha B'Av, people don't go to work, etc. So these are very serious days. Think of Tisha B'Av and you have an idea of what we're talking about. The Talmud Bavli says there's no such thing in Bavel. Why is there no such thing in Bavel? Well, there's at least two explanations. The first is very simple. There's no need for a Tanit Sibur in Bavel because there's no shortage of water. Because Bavel, which is Iraq today, as we all know, is a very arid country. It doesn't have very much rain, very little rain indeed. So how do they all survive? They have two great rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, right? The Parath and the Hidekel. That's where the water comes from. You don't need it, just like in Egypt, it's a very dry country, but it has the Nile. If you have a great river, you can support a lot of agriculture by building canals, etc., and you can become even a great empire and a breadbasket, which is exactly how all these river valley empires came into existence. The Egyptians and the Assyrians and the Babylonians are all river valley empires in arid countries, but they have lots of water because of these rivers. Eretz Israel, as the Torah says, is not such a country. We live from the rain of heaven, and therefore the situation is different. So one reason you don't have Tanit Sibur declared by the local Beit Din in Bavel is you don't need to, which is a good reason. But that's not a sufficient explanation, because there are other kinds of problems that require a public fast day. It may not be, rain is only one of them. It could be an infestation of locusts. It could be a neighboring nation which is amassing its army on the border to invade the country. That's called a tzara. That also requires a day of fasting and prayer, etc. So there are many reasons why you would need such a Tanit Sibur, a different kind, or a plague that's killing many people. And yet the Talmud Bavli says, "En Tanit Sibur beBavel." Why not? Why is there no Tanit Sibur in Bavel? The Ramban explains this simple fact in very simple terms. He says the reason there's no Beth Din, there's no Tanit Sibur in Bavel, is because there's no Beth Din in Bavel. What do you mean there's no Beth Din in Bavel? There are all these Amoraim, all these Chachamim, so why is there no Beth Din in Bavel? It's very simple. You can have all the Chachamim in the world, but if they're not empowered, if they don't have the official permission and they weren't officially nominated in the required way, and they don't have essentially what we call semicha, what's called semicha, which means that all people in that area are required to listen to them, as it were, by law. And if they don't, they can enforce what they say. Such a body, even if it's made up of very great people, or such a group of chachamim, is not a beth din. And such a body, therefore, can't declare a fast day. Because even if it does declare a fast day, you don't have to listen to them. He's telling you not to eat next Tuesday. Who is he to tell you not to eat next Tuesday? Now, if you happen to know who these chachamim are, and you think, well, these are very serious people, and they wouldn't make such a declaration if it were not necessary and proper, and therefore I will listen to them, that's very nice. You're a very fine Jew in that case. You're a Yudi Kasher Ma'od. But that's not a Beth Din. You're doing it because you agree with it. You think that they know what they're doing. You're accepting their authority because you choose to, not because they have authority. Whereas today, if if, for example, it were to happen, it's of course hypothetical, a government in Israel were to decide to freeze building and settlements, then it's not a question of whether, it's not up to you, at least not until the Magav and the riot police and what have you all arrive, to enforce this decision, this decision. It's not up to you to decide whether you accept the authority of the government or the body that made this decision. You're required, and if you don't do it, you'll be forced to do so. A Beth Din is a body that you must listen to. It's not a body that you choose to listen to.
Didn't we read earlier that it has to be a Beth Din that is accompanied by police?
Correct.
Police to back it up.
You're right.
It's not a Beth Din.
You're right. That's exactly right. And you're so right. I'll tell you that what you just said now is exactly what Chazal say. It says in the Sifrei, and it's quoted in Maseches Sanhedrin Dav Zayin, it says, Im yesh shoterim, yesh shofetim. Im en shoterim, en shofetim. That's true.
What doesn't make a difference what they have in this neighborhood, because even if there is a Beit Din in this neighborhood, there are no police.
You're right. There are no officers to enforce what they say. You're right. But it's more than that. Even before you get to the point of enforcement, that's true what you say. But beyond that, let's say you and I live in this neighborhood and we have a monetary dispute. And I say, all right, well, we have this problem. I think you owe me 1,000 shekel, and you're sure that you don't. Well, let's go to the Beit Din. And you say, no, I don't want to go. I'm sure that I'm right. I'm sure I don't owe you 1,000 shekel. I'm not going. Well, if I don't have a way of forcing you to go to this Beit Din, that's not a Beit Din. And I have no recourse also, right? So that's, sorry? You can't subpoena, right? If I can't subpoena you, then this system is not working. Then it's a voluntary system. A voluntary system is fine if everyone's a tremendous tzaddik and everyone listens to, and everyone wants to be entirely certain and they really are right, they don't owe the other guy 1,000 shekels. So everyone runs to the Beit Din to find out, maybe I do owe him 1,000 shekels. But if everyone's not that kind of a person, then you've got a problem. So the Ramban explains that in Chutz La'aretz there's no smicha, everyone knows that, everyone agrees to that, and a Beit Din which is not simuchim does not have the authority to do all kinds of things. And one of those things that it hasn't got the authority to do is to declare a fast day. And even if many Jews would listen to them if were they to do so, that still doesn't mean they have the authority. And a public fast day is a day when everyone has to fast. It's not something you can choose to do. It's something which it has to be. There has to be complete compliance, and it can be enforced also. So, in answer to your question, isn't it the case that there's always a Beit Din of three? I would say no. I would say, as far as I know, the opposite is the case. I know there's a Rav of this shul, or a Rav of this town, or a Rav of this shchuna, or a Rav of that yeshuv. I've never, almost never heard of having a Beit Din. So I was pointing out that a Beit Din is always at least three people. And the whole idea of having, for example, yeshuv, for argument's sake, 200 families, which is not even a very big yeshuv in Yudah and Shomron today, the idea that there should be a yeshuv where one person calls the shots, makes all the decisions of a Torah nature, and he is, as it were, as Chazal say, Dan Yahidi, he decides all these things alone. Is that a proper system? Is that how it's supposed to be? As far as I know, no, it's not how it's supposed to be. Yes, well.
Isn't there a lack of authority for the current issue that they have a rub?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. You're asking if he makes a certain psak halacha. You ask me, are the people in that community required to follow his psak halacha? I think what many people will do in that situation is they'll say, if it's a communal matter, then someone has to decide what the community is going to do, if it affects the community as a klal. But if it's a private matter, for instance, how long you wait, just for example, between meat and milk or something, then I have my rav, and my rav says this, and he says that. I don't have to listen to him. Mashal. Okay? But I don't know. It's anyone's guess.
Situation. I think what you're asking is whether you have one person in the yeshuv who's like the rav, and a fish, and according to halacha, it's not even, he doesn't have the ability to make a decision because you need three people minimum, or whether you did have a Beit Din of three people, it still doesn't make a difference in the yeshuv even today in Israel, because without somebody to enforce those decisions, three and one, it's nothing.
You're right. There's truth in what you say, but I would nevertheless claim that if you were to have in each If it was known to all people in all Yishuvim, just for example, in Yidam and Shomron, we're talking about Dati people, generally. If it was known that in this community there's a Beit Din of three, and they will, they're empowered to make decisions that affect the community and that are all issues connected to Torah come to them, I think, I'm sure you would have some people who would still want to listen, but and comply. But I'm sure other people would feel that this is something more serious that I should be more concerned with, more take more seriously, as opposed to one individual. And you may not like him for whatever reason, because you don't like the color of his hair, or because he has a funny nose, or whatever the reason, or he's not got the wrong kippah, he doesn't wear the right kind of hat. Who knows why you do or don't like him? And a person may think, you know, well, that's what he thinks. Who's he? But it doesn't have the. There's no. The term Beit Din carries a certain. Has a certain power to it, even if it can't be enforced. It's already one step in the right direction. Then the next step is to also be able to enforce its decisions. But first, have a Beit Din. But there's not even a Beit Din. That, I'm saying that is seems to me a major problem. Yes. Essentially, nothing is binding today on anybody. That's what the Ramban is really telling us. Even if you turn the clock back 1500 or 1800 years to Bavel, the time of Shmuel HaBavli, the time of the greatest Amoraim, Ramban is telling you, even then, if Jews listened to Shmuel HaBavli in Bavel 1700 years ago, it was because they knew that he's the ranking Chacham here in Bavel, or Rav, his colleague, is the ranking Chacham, and if they both say, the two of them, Rav and Shmuel, agree, this is what a good Jew should do, well then who else are you going to go by? Of course, and if you want to do the right thing, then that's what you do. But it's essentially because you choose to do so, at least up to a point. Although in those days they did have Batei Din, they did have Shoturim, they did have officers, they did enforce. The Gemara is full of stories about Amoraim who punished people by giving them a whipping for different offenses. So such things did exist. But nevertheless, the Ramban says that it didn't have the kind of authority that Beit Din Eretz Yisrael had, because they weren't semuchim. Today we're talking about something much, much weaker, much, much less than that. Today you don't have Batei Din that give out a whipping or punish in any such similar fashion. And the Batei Din that we have are essentially almost entirely of a voluntary nature. In other words, it's very hard to get someone else to go along to Beit Din if he doesn't want to. With the exception, perhaps, of that one area of human affairs, namely marriage and divorce, where the state of Israel, declares that by law these Batei Din have jurisdiction. And then, let's say a wife wants to take her husband to court, or vice versa, so then the issue can be forced, and decisions can be enforced. But that's only because the secular establishment says so, not because there's a Torah system in place, a functioning and healthy Torah system. At any rate, the hour is already getting late, and I don't want to go too long this evening. I think we should end here. As I said, I intend to continue on this theme in the coming weeks. So we'll see. There's much more to be said and to be discussed and understood when it comes to this question, this whole topic. But just to sum up, the title of the shiurah, as was advertised at least a couple of days ago, "Do You Live in a Jewish Community? Are You Sure?" I hope by now you will understand why the title included two question marks. Are there any questions? Pre-state things, pre-state things were not ideal, but much better than at present. Much, much better, because when the state came into being, David Ben-Gurion, who was a very wise and also cunning individual, he of course wanted to ensure that the religious establishment was under his control. I'm sure, I'm not guessing now, I'm convinced that he read the works of Machiavelli. He had a huge library, by the way, and as opposed to many people who have huge libraries, he actually read the books that had been going on, and he was something of an intellectual as well, and he knew that, as Machiavelli tells us, that, and as I pointed out, I think in the last shiur, that Paro already knew this also, because he, as we saw in the parasha, in Parashat Vayigash, that Paro paid the salaries of the Kohanim in Mitzrayim. So he also understood this, apparently. So as Machiavelli writes, if a government or an individual wishes to rule, particularly as in a totalitarian fashion, wants to have complete control of society, he must control the religious apparatus of that society. Otherwise, he's going to have an inbuilt opposition, or at least the possibility of an inbuilt opposition within the society, which is independent of himself or of the system. And that a system that wishes to control everything can't allow to exist. Therefore, what do? You either eradicate it, which is what they did in communist countries, eradicate the religious establishment altogether, or almost altogether,
or you
buy them off, right? In other words, you set up a system where we'll elect the rabbis and the dayanim that are suit our purposes. What does that mean? The kind that won't rock the boat, that won't say the wrong thing, won't say things that are uncomfortable, unpleasant, inconvenient to hear, or that other people shouldn't hear, and we'll pay you a nice salary. Higher up the ladder you go, you even get a car, a chauffeur, a nice big office, secretaries, everything that you need, you'll get, but there's the strings attached. And the strings that are attached are very easy to see. They're big bright red strings. They're very easy to see. The strings are, you don't interfere with all the important things. What are the important things? Everything that we do, everything that we, the government and the politicians, etc., and the secular cause, everything that we do, you have nothing to do with. What are the crumbs that we're throwing in your direction? You can be in charge of marriage and divorce, and that also, by the way, has been whittled away to a very large extent over the last 20 or so years. In other words,
at least the education, to a degree.
You're right. Everything's been has been a deliberate attempt to even those few prerogatives or responsibilities that the Batei Din or certain religious bodies had, to a large extent, have been whittled down to almost nothing. Certainly, anything to do with what certain people choose to call politics, or anything to do with anything beyond, I'll tell you, the definition is simple. If it involves something like how you're going to make a cup of tea on Shabbat, whether you use a tea bag in a Kli Shlishi or you make tea the day before, that's your purview. You're in charge of that one. Or you wonder if the question is this chicken kosher or not, that's your decision. That, by the way, also is being challenged to some extent at the present time. And also, this person's Jewish or not, Giyor or not Giyor, well, that's your department. Because why? Because we don't really care too much about these things. But anything of note, anything of real weight or importance, don't get involved. That's the setup. And most of the rabbinical establishment, of all stripes, by the way, are willing to go along with this, because it's a fairly lucrative source of income for a lot of people. There are Rabbanim Rashiim, Rabbanei Arim of large cities, and Rabbanei Shkunoth, and Rabbanei Batei Knesset, and the Rabbanim of regions. Like a certain region that has 10 Moshavim, so he's a Rav of those, that area, and those 10 Moshavim, for example. What's demanded of you is often not very great. The pay is not bad, sometimes very good. Dayanim certainly get paid very well. And as long as they don't interfere with the important matters of state, everyone's happy. At least some people are happy. I'm not very happy. I don't think it's a very good state of affairs at all, but that's the system. So either you control, either you eradicate the religion and the religious establishment and all the centers of power that are a function of that religion, or you buy them off and you control them. So Ben-Gurion put in place a system by which he was able to control the whole setup, which didn't exist before the state came into existence. Rav Kook, for example, it's very improper, I think, to refer to Rav Kook as Harav HaRashi Yisrael or something like that, because he wasn't. Because he wasn't chosen, for example, in the same fashion as Rabbanim Rashim are chosen today. At that time, it really was the collective and essentially almost unanimous opinion of all Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael that he should be the head, for example. And it was a much more autonomous sincere procedure by which he and others like him were chosen. Whereas once the state came into being, it was all regulated in a very, very carefully planned and very specific way to ensure that the political echelon would control everything that goes on in the religious establishment. So, just for example, chief rabbis of Israel today are to be chosen by an electoral body, I think according to the law, of 150 individuals. Those 150 individuals are made up, if I'm not mistaken, of 80 dayanim and 70 politicians, representatives of political parties in the Knesset. Which already means, by the way, that a party like Balad, the Arab party, has a representative, and Kadima has a representative, because they, of course, they know a lot about these things and they care as much. And every party, no matter who you are, you have a representative according to the size of your party on this body. You may say, well, they're only 70. The majority is of the body is 80, the Dayanim. Well, that's also a bit of a joke, because there are, for argument's sake, hundreds of Dayanim in the country. So who chose that? How did you get to those particular 80? Those 80 are obviously chosen for very specific reasons, in some convoluted manner, to ensure that the result will be as you want it to be.
And since they're probable to a degree.
Of course, to a very large degree. And, again, because the politicians and these Dayanim very often each have their own agendas, they're willing to cut deals, and they vote en bloc. In other words, you go along with us and vote for this guy, for Sfaradichi, and we'll vote for your Ashkenazi guy. We couldn't care less. We don't even know who he is. But we want this guy because we know he's more for giving land away for peace. He's going to be easier in terms of that. So we want this guy in that position, and you scratch our back, we'll scratch your back, etc. That's how it works. That's obviously not a way to establish any kind of Torah establishment or any kind of Jewish community. But we'll leave it at that for now. Kol Tuf.